26. Roland descended into dusky pink light. Oi's bright eyes peered out from the open V of his shirt. His neck stretched to the limit of its considerable length as he sniffed at the warm air that blew through the ventilator grills. Roland had had to depend completely on the bumbler's nose in the dark passages above, and he had been terribly afraid the animal would lose Jake's scent in the running water. But when he had heard the sound of singing, first Gasher, then Jake, echoing back through the pipes, he had relaxed a little. Oi had not led them wrong. Oi had heard it, too. Up until then, he had been moving slowly and cautiously, even backtracking every now and again to be sure of himself. But when he heard Jake's voice, he began to run, straining the rawhide leash. Roland was afraid he might call after Jake in his harsh voice, "Ake, ake!" But he hadn't done so. And just as they reached the shaft which led to the lower levels of this Dicean maze, Roland had heard the sound of some new machine, a pump of some sort, perhaps, followed by the metallic, echoing crash of a door being slammed shut. He reached the foot of the square tunnel and glanced briefly at the double line of lighted tubes which led off in either direction. They were lit with swamp fire, he saw, like the sign outside the place which had belonged to Balazar in the city of New York. He looked more closely at the narrow chrome ventilation strips running along the top of each wall and the arrows below them, then slipped the rawhide loop off Oi's neck. Oi shook his head impatiently, clearly glad to be rid of it. "We're close," he murmured into the bumbler's cocked ear, "and so we have to be quiet. You understand, Oi? Very quiet."
"Quiet,"
Oi replied in a hoarse whisper that would have been funny under other circumstances. Roland put him down, and Oi was immediately off down the tunnel, neck out, muzzle to the steel floor. Roland could hear him muttering, "Ick, ick, ick," under his breath. Roland unholstered his gun and followed him. 27. Eddie and Susanna looked up at the vastness of Blaine's cradle as the skies opened and the rain began to fall in torrents.
"It's a hell of a building, but they forgot the handicap ramps,"
Eddie yelled, raising his voice to be heard over the rain and thunder.
"Never mind that," Susanna said impatiently, slipping out of the wheelchair. "Let's get up there and out of the rain."
Eddie looked dubiously up the incline of steps. The risers were shallow, but there were a lot of them.
"You sure, Suze?"
"Race, you white boy,"
she said, and began to wriggle upward with uncanny ease, using hands, muscular forearms, and the stumps of her legs. And she almost did beat him. Eddie had the ironmongery to contend with, and it slowed him down. Both of them were panting when they reached the top, and tendrils of steam were rising from their wet clothes. Eddie grabbed her under the arms, swung her up, and then just held her with his hands locked together in the small of her back instead of dropping her back into the chair as he had meant to do. He felt randy and half crazy without the slightest idea why.
"Oh, give me a break," he thought. "You've gotten this far alive. That's what's got your glands pumped up and ready to potty."
Susanna licked her full lower lip and wound her strong fingers into his hair. She pulled. It hurt, and at the same time it felt wonderful. "Told you I'd beat you, white boy," she said in a low, husky voice.
"Get out of here. I had you by half a step."
He tried to sound less out of breath than he was and found it was impossible.
"Maybe, but it blew you out, didn't it?"
One hand left his hair, slid downward, and squeezed gently. A smile gleamed in her eyes.
"Something ain't blown out, though."
Thunder rumbled across the sky. They flinched, then laughed together.
"Come on," he said. "This is nuts. The time's all wrong."
She didn't contradict him, but she squeezed him again before returning her hand to his shoulder. Eddie felt a pang of regret as he swung her back into her chair and ran her across vast flagstones and under cover of the roof. He thought he saw the same regret in Susanna's eyes. When they were out of the downpour, Eddie paused and they looked back. The plaza of the cradle, the street of the turtle, and all the city beyond was rapidly disappearing into a shifting gray curtain. Eddie wasn't a bit sorry. Ludd hadn't earned itself a place in his mental scrapbook of fond memories.
"Look," Susanna murmured.
She was pointing at a nearby downspout. It ended in a large, scaly fish head that looked like a close relation to the dragon gargoyles which decorated the corners of the cradle.
Water ran from its mouth in a silver torrent.
"This isn't just a passing shower, is it?" Eddie asked.
"Nope. It's gonna rain until it gets tired of it, and then it's gonna rain some more just for spite. Maybe a week, maybe a month. Not that it's gonna matter to us if Blaine decides he doesn't like our looks and fries us. Fire a shot to let Roland know we got here, sugar, and then we'll have us a look around, see what we can see."
Eddie pointed the Ruger into the gray sky, pulled the trigger, and fired the shot which Roland heard a mile or more away as he followed Jake and Gasher through the booby-trapped maze. Eddie stood where he was a moment longer, trying to persuade himself that things might still turn out all right, that his heart was wrong in its stubborn insistence that they had seen the last of the gunslinger and the boy Jake. Then he made the automatic safe again, returned it to the waistband of his pants, and went back to Susanna. He turned her chair away from the steps and rolled her along an aisle of columns which led deeper into the building. She popped the cylinder of Roland's gun and reloaded it as they went. Under the roof, the rain had a secret, ghostly sound, and even the harsh thunder cracks were muted. The columns which supported the structure were at least 10 feet in diameter, and their tops were lost in the gloom. From up there in the shadows, Eddie heard the cooing conversation of pigeons. Now a sign hanging on thick chrome-silver chains swam out of the shadows. North Central Positronics welcomes you to the cradle of Ludd. Southeast travel, Blaine. Northwest travel, Patricia.
"Now we know the name of the one that fell in the river," Eddie said. "Patricia. They got the colors wrong, though. Supposed to be pink for girls and blue for boys, not the other way around."
"Maybe they're both blue."
"They're not. Blaine's pink."
"How would you know that?"
Eddie looked confused.
"I don't know how, but I do."
They followed the arrow pointing toward Blaine's berth, entering what had to be a grand concourse. Eddie didn't have Susanna's ability to see the past in clear, visionary flashes, but his imagination nonetheless filled this vast pillared space with 1,000 hurrying people. He heard clicking heels and murmuring voices, saw embraces of homecoming and farewell. And over everything, the speakers chanting news of 12 different destinations. "Patricia is now boarding for Northwest Baronese. Will passenger Killington, please report to the information booth on the lower level. Blaine is now arriving at berth number 2 and will be debarking shortly."
Now, there was only the pigeons. Eddie shivered.
"Look at the faces," Susanna murmured.
"I don't know if they give you the willies, but they sure do me."
She was pointing to the right. High up on the wall, a series of sculpted heads seemed to push out of the marble, peering down at them from the shadows. Stern men with the harsh faces of executioners who are happy in their work. Some of the faces had fallen from their places and lay in granite shards and splinters 70 or 80 feet below their peers. Those remaining were spider-webbed with cracks and splattered with pigeon dung.
"They must have been a Supreme Court or something," Eddie said, uneasily scanning all those thin lips and cracked, empty eyes. "Only judges can look so smart and so completely pissed off at the same time. You're talking to a guy who knows. There isn't one of them who looks like he'd give a crippled crab a crutch."
"A heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter,"
Susanna murmured, and at these words Eddie felt goose flesh waltz across the skin of his arms and chest and legs.
"What's that, Suze?"
"A poem by a man who must have seen Ludd in his dreams," she said. "Come on, Eddie, forget him."
"Easier said than done."
But he began to push her again. Ahead, a vast grilled barrier like a castle barbican swam out of the gloom, and beyond it, they caught their first glimpse of Blaine the Mono. It was pink, just as Eddie had said it would be, a delicate shade which matched the veins running through the marble pillars. Blaine flowed above the wide loading platform in a smooth, streamlined bullet shape which looked more like flesh than metal. Its surface was broken only once by a triangular window equipped with a huge wiper.
Eddie knew there would be another triangular window with another big wiper on the other side of the Mono's nose, so that if you looked at Blaine head-on, it would seem to have a face, just like Charlie the Choo-Choo. The wipers would look like slyly drooping eyelids. White light from the southeastern slot in the cradle fell across Blaine in a long, distorted rectangle. To Eddie, the body of the train looked like the breaching back of some fabulous pink whale, one that was utterly silent.
"Wow." His voice had fallen to a whisper. "We found it."
"Yes. Blaine the Mono."
"Is it dead, do you think?" "It looks dead."
"It's not. Sleeping, maybe, but a long way from dead."
"You sure?"
"Were you sure it would be pink?"
It wasn't a question he had to answer, and he didn't. The face she turned up to him was strained and badly frightened.
"It's sleeping, and you know what? I'm scared to wake it up."
"Well, we'll wait for the others, then."
She shook her head. "I think we better try to be ready for when they get here, because I've got an idea that they're going to come on the run. Push me over to that box mounted on the bars. It looks like an intercom. See it?"
He did, and pushed her slowly toward it. It was mounted on one side of a closed gate in the center of the barrier which ran the length of the cradle. The vertical bars of the barrier were made of what looked like stainless steel. Those of the gate appeared to be ornamental iron, and their lower ends disappeared into steel-ringed holes in the floor. There was no way either of them was going to wiggle through those bars either, Eddie saw. The gap between each set was no more than 4 inches. It would have been a tight squeeze even for Oi. Pigeons ruffled and cooed overhead. The left wheel of Susanna's chair squawked monotonously.
"My kingdom for an oil can," Eddie thought, and realized he was a lot more than just scared.
The last time he had felt this level of terror had been on the day when he and Henry had stood on the sidewalk of Reinhold Street in Dutch Hill, looking at the slumped ruin of the mansion. They hadn't gone in on that day in 1977. They had turned their backs on the haunted house and walked away, and he remembered vowing to himself that he would never, never, ever go back to that place. It was a promise he'd kept, but here he was, in another haunted house, and there was the haunter, right over there, Blaine the Mono, a long, low, pink shape with one window peering at him like the eye of a dangerous animal who is shamming sleep.
"He stirs no more from his birth in the cradle. He has even stopped speaking in his many voices and laughing. Artis was the last to go nigh Blaine, and when Artis couldn't answer what was asked, Blaine slew him with blue fire."
"If it speaks to me, I'll probably go crazy," Eddie thought.
The wind gusted outside, and a fine spray of rain flew in through the tall egress slot cut in the side of the building. He saw it strike Blaine's window and beat up there. Eddie shuddered suddenly and looked sharply around.
"We're being watched. I can feel it."
"I wouldn't be at all surprised. Push me closer to the gate, Eddie. I want to get a better look at that box."
"Okay, but don't touch it if it's electrified."
"If Blaine wants to cook us, he will,"
Susanna said, looking through the bars at Blaine's back. "You know it, and I do too." And because Eddie knew that was only the truth, he said nothing. The box looked like a combination intercom and burglar alarm. There was a speaker set into the top half with what looked like a talk-listen button next to it. Below this were numbers arranged in a shape which made a diamond. Under the diamond were two other buttons with words of the high speech printed on them, Command and Enter. Susanna looked bewildered and doubtful.
"What is this thing, do you think? It looks like a gadget in a science fiction movie."
"Of course it did," Eddie realized. Susanna had probably seen a home security system or two in her time. She had, after all, lived among the Manhattan rich, even if she had not been very enthusiastically accepted by them. But there was a world of difference between the electronics gear available in her Wen, 1963, and his own, which was 1987.
"We've never talked much about the differences either," he thought. "I wonder what she'd think if I told her Ronald Reagan was President of the United States when Roland snatched me. Probably that I was crazy."
"It's a security system," he said. Then, although his nerves and instincts screamed out against it, he forced himself to reach out with his right hand and thumb the talk-listen switch. There was no crackle of electricity, no deadly blue fire went racing up his arm, no sign that the thing was even still connected. Maybe Blaine is dead. Maybe he's dead after all. But he didn't really believe that. "Hello?" he said, and in his mind's eye saw the unfortunate artist screaming as he was microwaved by the blue fire dancing all over his face and body, melting his eyes and setting his hair ablaze. "Hello, Blaine? Anybody?" He let go of the button and waited, stiff with tension. Susanna's hand crept into his, cold and small. There was still no answer, and Eddie, now more reluctant than ever, pushed the button again. "Blaine?" He let go of the button, waited, and when there was still no answer, a dangerous giddiness overcame him, as it often did in moments of stress and fear. When that giddiness took him, counting the cost no longer seemed to matter. Nothing mattered. It had been like that when he had outfaced Balazar's sallow-faced contact man in Nassau, and it was like that now. And if Roland had seen him in the moment this lunatic impatience overtook him, he would have seen more than just a resemblance between Eddie and Cuthbert. He would have sworn Eddie was Cuthbert. He jammed the button in with his thumb and began to bellow into the speaker, adopting a plummy and completely bogus British accent.
"Hello, Blaine. Cheerio, old fellow. This is Robin Leach, host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Brainless, here to tell you that you have won $6 billion and a new Ford Escort in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes."
Pigeons took flight above them in soft, startled explosions of wings. Susanna gasped. Her face wore the dismayed expression of a devout woman who has just heard her husband blaspheme in a cathedral.
"Eddie, stop it! Stop it!"
Eddie couldn't stop it. His mouth was smiling, but his eyes glittered with a mixture of fear, hysteria, and frustrated anger.
"You and your monorail girlfriend, Patricia, will spend a luxurious month in scenic Jimtown, where you'll drink only the finest wine and eat only the finest virgins. You sh—"
Eddie broke off, looking at Susanna. He was at once sure that it had been she who had shushed him, not only because she had already tried, but because she was the only other person here. And yet at the same time he knew it hadn't been Susanna. That had been another voice, the voice of a very young and very frightened child. "Suze, did you—" Susanna was shaking her head and raising her hand at the same time. She pointed at the intercom box, and Eddie saw the button marked Command was glowing a very faint shell pink. It was the same color as the mono sleeping in its berth on the other side of the barrier.
"Shh! Don't wake him up," the child's voice mourned.
It drifted from the speaker, soft as an evening breeze. "What?" Eddie began. Then he shook his head, reached toward the talk-listen switch, and pressed it gently. When he spoke again, it was not in the blaring Robin Leach bellow, but in the almost whisper of a conspirator.
"What are you? Who are you?"
He released the button. He and Susanna regarded each other with the big eyes of children who now know they are sharing the house with a dangerous, perhaps psychotic, adult. How have they come by the knowledge? Why, because another child has told them, a child who has lived with a psychotic adult for a long time, hiding in corners and stealing out only when it knows the adult is asleep, a frightened child who happens to be almost invisible. There was no answer. Eddie let the seconds spin out. Each one seemed long enough to read a whole novel in. He was reaching for the button again when the faint pink glow reappeared.
"I'm little Blaine," the child's voice whispered. "The one he doesn't see. The one he forgot. The one he thinks he left behind in the rooms of ruin and the halls of the dead."
Eddie pushed the button again with a hand that had picked up an uncontrollable shake. He could hear that shake in his voice as well.
Who is the one who doesn't see? Is it the bear?"
"No, not the bear, not he. Shardik lay dead in the forest, many miles behind them. The world had moved on, even since then." Eddie suddenly remembered what it had been like to lay his ear against that strange, unfound door in the clearing where the bear had lived its violent half-life, that door with its somehow terrible stripes of yellow and black. It was all of a piece, he realized now, all part of some awful, decaying whole, a tattered web with the dark tower at its center like an incomprehensible stone spider. All of Midworld had become one vast haunted mansion in these strange latter days. All of Midworld had become the drawers. All of Midworld had become a wasteland, haunting and haunted. He saw Susanna's lips form the words of the real answer before the voice from the intercom could speak them, and those words were as obvious as the solution to a riddle once the answer is spoken.
"Big Blaine," the unseen voice whispered. "Big Blaine is the ghost in the machine, the ghost in all the machines."
Susanna's hand had gone to her throat and was clutching it as if she intended to strangle herself. Her eyes were full of terror, but they were not glassy, not stunned. They were sharp with understanding. Perhaps she knew a voice like this one from her own Wen, the Wen where the integrated whole that was Susanna had been shunted aside by the warring personalities of Detta and Odetta. The childish voice had surprised her as well as him, but her agonized eyes said she was no stranger to the concept being expressed. Susanna knew all about the madness of duality.
"Eddie, we have to go," she said.
Her terror turned the words into an unpunctuated auditory smear. He could hear air whistling in her windpipe like a cold wind around a chimney.
"Eddie, we have to get away. Eddie, we have to get away. Eddie, too late,"
the tiny mourning voice said.
"He's awake. Big Blaine is awake. He knows you are here, and he's coming."
Suddenly lights, bright orange arc sodiums, began to flash on in pairs above them, bathing the pillared vastness of the cradle in a harsh glare that banished all shadows. Hundreds of pigeons darted and swooped in frightened, aimless flight, startled from their complex of interlocked nests high above.
"Wait!" Eddie shouted. "Please wait!"
In his agitation, he forgot to push the button, but it made no difference. Little Blaine responded anyway.
"No, I can't let him catch me. I can't let him kill me, too."
The light on the intercom box went dark again, but only for a moment. This time both command and enter lit up, and their color was not pink, but the lurid dark red of a blacksmith's forge.
"Who are you?"
A voice roared, and it came not just from the box, but from every speaker in the city which still operated. The rotting bodies hanging from the poles shivered with the vibrations of that mighty voice. It seemed that even the dead would run from Blaine if they could. Susanna shrank back in her chair, the heels of her hands pressed to her ears, her face long with dismay, her mouth distorted in a silent scream. Eddie felt himself shrinking toward all the fantastic, hallucinatory terrors of 11. Had it been this voice he had feared when he and Henry stood outside the mansion, that he had perhaps even anticipated? He didn't know. But he did know how Jack in that old story must have felt when he realized that he had tried the beanstalk once too often and awakened the giant.
"How dare you disturb my sleep? Tell me now, or die where you stand."
He might have frozen right there, leaving Blaine, Big Blaine, to do to them whatever it was he had done to Artis, or something even worse. Perhaps should have frozen, locked in that down-the-rabbit-hole fairy-tale terror. It was the memory of the small voice which had spoken first that enabled him to move. It had been the voice of a terrified child, but it had tried to help them, terrified or not. "So now you have to help yourself," he thought. "You woke it up. Deal with it, for Christ's sake." Eddie reached out and pushed the button again.
"My name is Eddie Dean. The woman with me is my wife, Susanna. We're...
He looked at Susanna, who nodded and made frantic motions for him to go on.
"We're on a quest. We seek the Dark Tower, which lies in the path of the beam. We're in the company of two others, Roland of Gilead and Jake of New York. We're from New York, too. If you're..."
He paused for a moment, biting back the words "Big Blaine." If he used them, he might make the intelligence behind the voice aware that they had heard another voice, a ghost inside the ghost, so to speak. Susanna gestured again for him to go on, using both hands.
"If you're Blaine the Mono, well, we want you to take us."
He released the button. There was no response for what seemed like a very long time, only the agitated flutter of the disturbed pigeons from overhead. When Blaine spoke again, his voice came only from the speaker box mounted on the gate and sounded almost human. "Do not try my patience. All the doors to that wear are closed. Gilead is no more, and those known as gunslingers are all dead. Now answer my question. Who are you? This is your last chance." There was a sizzling sound. A ray of brilliant blue-white light lanced down from the ceiling and seared a hole the size of a golf ball in the marble floor less than 5 feet to the left of Susanna's wheelchair. Smoke that smelled like the aftermath of a lightning bolt rose lazily from it. Susanna and Eddie stared at each other in mute terror for a moment, and then Eddie lunged for the communicator box and thumbed the button. "You're wrong. We did come from New York. We came through the doors on the beach only a few weeks ago." "It's true," Susanna called. "I swear it is." Silence. Beyond the long barrier, Blaine's pink back humped smoothly. The window at the front seemed to regard them like a vapid glass eye. The wiper could have been a lid half-closed in a sly wink. "Prove it," Blaine said at last.
"Christ, how do I do that?" Eddie asked Susanna.
"I don't know."
Eddie pushed the button again. "The Statue of Liberty. Does that ring a bell?"
"Go on," Blaine said. Now the voice sounded almost thoughtful.
The Empire State Building, the Stock Exchange, the World Trade Center, Coney Island Red Hots, Radio City Music Hall, the East Village..."
Blaine cut him off.
And now, incredibly, the voice which came from the speaker was the drawling voice of John Wayne.
"Okay, Pilgrim, I believe ya."
Eddie and Susanna shared another glance, this one of confusion and relief. But when Blaine spoke again, the voice was again cold and emotionless.
"Ask me a question, Eddie Dean of New York, and it better be a good one." There was a pause, and then Blaine added, "Because if it's not, you and your woman are going to die, no matter where you came from."
Susanna looked from the box on the gate to Eddie.
"What's it talking about?" she hissed.
Eddie shook his head.
"I don't have the slightest idea."
28. To Jake, the room Gasher dragged him into looked like a Minuteman missile silo which had been decorated by the inmates of a lunatic asylum. Part museum, part living room, part hippie crash pad. Above him, empty space vaulted up to a rounded ceiling, and below him it dropped 75 or 100 feet to a similarly rounded base. Running all around the single curved wall in vertical lines were tubes of neon in alternating strokes of color. Red, blue, green, yellow, orange, peach, pink. These long tubes came together in roaring rainbow knots at the bottom and top of the silo, if that was what it had been. The room was about 3/4 of the way up the vast capsule-shaped space and floored with rusty iron grillwork. Rugs that looked Turkish, he later learned that such rugs were actually from a barony called Kashmin, lay on the grilled floor here and there. Their corners were held down with brass-bound trunks or standing lamps or the squat legs of overstuffed chairs. If not, they would have flapped like strips of paper tied to an electric fan, because a steady warm draft rushed up from below. Another draft, this one issuing from a circular band of ventilators like the ones in the tunnel they had followed here, swirled about 4 or 5 feet above Jake's head. On the far side of the room was a door identical to the one through which he and Gasher had entered, and Jake assumed it was a continuation of the subterranean corridor following the path of the beam. There were 6 people in the room, 4 men and 2 women. Jake guessed that he was looking at the gray high command, if, that was, there were enough grays left to warrant a high command. None of them were young, but all were still in the prime of their lives. They looked at Jake as curiously as he looked at them. Sitting in the center of the room, with one massive leg thrown casually over the arm of a chair big enough to be a throne, was a man who looked like a cross between a Viking warrior and a giant from a child's fairy tale. His heavily muscled upper body was naked except for a silver band around one bicep, a knife scabbard looped over one shoulder, and a strange charm about his neck. His lower body was clad in soft, tight-fitting leather breeches, which were tucked into high boots. He wore a yellow scarf tied around one of these. His hair, a dirty gray-blonde, cascaded almost to the middle of his broad back. His eyes were as green and curious as the eyes of a tomcat who is old enough to be wise, but not old enough to have lost that refined sense of cruelty which passes for fun in feline circles. Hung by its strap from the back of the chair was what looked like a very old machine gun. Jake looked more closely at the ornament on the Viking's chest and saw that it was a coffin-shaped glass box hung on a silver chain. Inside it, a tiny gold clock face marked the time at 3:05. Below the face, a tiny gold pendulum went back and forth, and despite the soft whoosh of circulating air from above and below, he could hear the tick-tock sound it made. The hands of the clock were moving faster than they should have done, and Jake was not very surprised to see that they were moving backward. He thought of the crocodile in Peter Pan, the one that was always chasing after Captain Hook, and a little smile touched his lips. Gasher saw it and raised his hand. Jake cringed away, putting his own hands to his face. The tick-tock man shook his finger at Gasher in an amusing schoolmarmish gesture.
Now, no need of that, Gasher, he said.
Gasher lowered his hand at once. His face had changed completely. Before, it had alternated between stupid rage and a species of cunning, almost existential humor. Now he only looked servile and adoring. Like the others in the room, and Jake himself, the Gasher man could not look away from Tick-Tock for long. His eyes were drawn inexorably back. And Jake could understand why. The Tick-Tock man was the only person here who seemed wholly vital, wholly healthy, and wholly alive.
"If you say there's no need, there ain't," Gasher said.
But he favored Jake with a dark look before shifting his eyes back to the blonde giant on the throne.
"Still, he's very pert, Ticky, very pert, Ticky, very pert indeed, so he is. And if you want my opinion, he'll take a deal of training."
"When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it," the Tick-Tock man said. "Now close the door, Gash, was you born in a barn?"
A dark-haired woman laughed shrilly, a sound like the caw of a crow. Tick-Tock flicked his eyes toward her. She quieted at once and cast her eyes down to the grilled floor. The door through which Gasher had dragged him was actually two doors. The arrangement reminded Jake of the way spaceship airlocks looked in the more intelligent science fiction movies. Gasher shut them both and turned to Tick-Tock, giving him a thumbs-up gesture. The Tick-Tock man nodded and reached languidly up to press a button set into a piece of furniture that looked like a speaker's podium. A pump began to cycle wheezily within the wall, and the neon tubes dimmed perceptibly. There was a faint hiss of air, and the valve wheel of the inside door spun shut. Jake supposed the one in the outer door was doing the same. This was some sort of bomb shelter, all right, no doubt of that. When the pump died, the long neon tubes resumed their former muted brilliance.
"There," Tick-Tock said pleasantly.
His eyes began to look Jake up and down. Jake had a clear and very uncomfortable sense of being expertly catalogued and filed.
"All safe and sound we are. Snug as bugs in a rug, right, Hoots?"
"We are,"
a tall, skinny man in a black suit replied promptly. His face was covered with some sort of rash, which he scratched obsessively.
"I brung him,"
Gasher said.
"I told you could trust me to do it, and didn't I?"
"You did," Tick-Tock said. "Bang on. I had some doubts about your ability to remember the password at the end there," but the dark-haired woman uttered another shrill caw.
The Tick-Tock man half turned in her direction, that lazy smile dimpling the corners of his mouth, and before Jake was able to grasp what was happening, what had already happened, she was staggering backward, her eyes bulging in surprise and pain, her hands groping at some strange tumor in the middle of her chest, which hadn't been there a second before. Jake realized the Tick-Tock man had made some sort of move as he was turning, a move so quick it had been no more than a flicker. The slim white hilt which had protruded from the scabbard looped over the Tick-Tock man's shoulder was gone. The knife was now on the other side of the room, sticking out of the dark-haired woman's chest. Tick-Tock had drawn and thrown with an uncanny speed Jake wasn't sure even Roland could match.
It had been like some malign magic trick. The others watched silently as the woman staggered toward TikTok, gagging harshly, her hands wrapped loosely around the hilt of the knife. Her hip bumped one of the standing lamps, and the one called Hoots darted forward to catch it before it could fall. TikTok himself never moved. He only went on sitting with his leg tossed over the arm of his throne, watching the woman with his lazy smile. Her foot caught beneath one of the rugs, and she tumbled forward. Once more the TikTok man moved with that spooky speed, pulling back the foot which had been dangling over the arm of the chair, and then driving it forward again like a piston. It buried itself in the pit of the dark-haired woman's stomach, and she went flying backward. Blood spewed from her mouth and splattered the furniture. She struck the wall, slid down it, and ended up sitting with her chin on her breastbone. To Jake, she looked like a movie Mexican taking a siesta against an adobe wall. It was hard for him to believe she had gone from living to dead with such terrible speed. Neon tubes turned her hair into a haze that was half red and half blue. Her glazing eyes stared at the TikTok man with terminal amazement. "I told her about that laugh," TikTok said. His eyes shifted to the other woman, a heavy-set redhead who looked like a long-haul trucker. "Didn't I, Tilly?" "Aye," Tilly said at once. Her eyes were lustrous with fear and excitement, and she licked her lips obsessively.
"So you did, many and many a time. I'll set my watch and ward on it."
"So you might if you could reach up your fat ass far enough to find them," TikTok said. "Bring me my knife, Brandon, and mind you wipe that slut stink off it before you put it in my hand."
A short, bandy-legged man hopped to do as he had been bidden. The knife wouldn't come free at first. It seemed caught on the unfortunate dark-haired woman's breastbone. Brandon threw a terrified glance over his shoulder at the TikTok man and then tugged harder. TikTok, however, appeared to have forgotten all about both Brandon and the woman who had literally laughed herself to death. His brilliant green eyes had fixed on something which interested him much more than the dead woman.
"Come here, Cully," he said. "I want a better look at you."
Gasher gave him a shove. Jake stumbled forward. He would have fallen if TikTok's strong hands hadn't caught him by the shoulders. Then, when he was sure Jake had his balance again, TikTok grasped the boy's left wrist and raised it. It was Jake's Seiko which had drawn his interest.
"If this here's what I think it is, it's an omen for sure and true," TikTok said. "Talk to me, boy. What's this sigil you wear?"
Jake, who hadn't the slightest idea what a sigil was, could only hope for the best.
"It's a watch. But it doesn't work, Mr. TikTok."
Hoots chuckled at that, then clapped both hands over his mouth when the TikTok man turned to look at him. After a moment, TikTok looked back at Jake, and a sunny smile replaced the frown. Looking at that smile almost made you forget that it was a dead woman and not a movie Mexican taking a siesta over there against the wall. Looking at it almost made you forget that these people were crazy, and the TikTok man was likely the craziest inmate in the whole asylum.
"Watch," TikTok said, nodding. "Aye, a likely enough name for such. After all, what does a person want with a timepiece but to watch it once in a while? Aye, Brandon, aye, Tilly, aye, Gasher?"
They responded with eager affirmatives. The TikTok man favored them with his winning smile, then turned back to Jake again. Now Jake noticed that the smile, winning or not, stopped well short of the TikTok man's green eyes. They were as they had been throughout, cool, cruel, and curious. He reached a finger toward the Seiko, which now proclaimed the time to be 91 minutes past 7, a.m. and p.m., and pulled it back just before touching the glass above the liquid crystal display.
"Tell me, dear boy, is this watch of yours booby-rigged?"
"Huh? Oh, no. No, it's not booby-rigged."
Jake touched his own finger to the face of the watch.
"That means nothing if it's set to the frequency of your own body," the TikTok man said.
He spoke in the sharp, scornful tone Jake's father used when he didn't want people to figure out that he didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about. TikTok glanced briefly at Brandon, and Jake saw him weigh the pros and cons of making the bow-legged man his designated toucher. Then he dismissed the notion and looked back into Jake's eyes.
If this thing gives me a shock, my little friend, you're going to be choking to death on your own sweetmeats in 30 seconds.
Jake swallowed hard but said nothing. The TikTok man reached out his finger again and this time allowed it to settle on the face of the Seiko. The moment that it did, all the numbers went to zeros and then began to count upward again. TikTok's eyes had narrowed in a grimace of potential pain as he touched the face of the watch. Now their corners crinkled in the first genuine smile Jake had seen from him. He thought it was partly pleasure at his own courage, but mostly simple wonder and interest.
"May I have it?" he asked Jake silkily, as a gesture of your good will, shall we say. "I am something of a clock fancier, my dear young collie, so I am."
"Be my guest." Jake stripped the watch off his arm at once and dropped it onto the TikTok man's large, waiting palm.
"Talks just like a little silk-arse gentleman, don't he?" Gasher said happily. "In old days, someone would have paid a very high price for the return of such as him, Tiki. Aye, so they would. Why, my father, your father, died so blowed out rotten with the mandrus that not even the dogs would eat him," the TikTok man interrupted. "Now shut up, you idiot."
At first, Gasher looked furious, and then only abashed. He sank into a nearby chair and closed his mouth. TikTok, meanwhile, was examining the Seiko's expansion band with an expression of awe. He pulled it wide, let it snap back, pulled it wide again, let it snap back again. He dropped a lock of his hair into the open links, then laughed when they closed on it. At last he slipped the watch over his hand and pushed it halfway up his forearm. Jake thought this souvenir of New York looked very strange there, but said nothing.
"Wonderful!" TikTok exclaimed. "Where did you get it, Cully?"
"It was a birthday present for my father and mother," Jake said.
Gasher leaned forward at this, perhaps wanting to mention the idea of ransom again. If so, the intent look on the TikTok man's face changed his mind, and he sat back without saying anything.
"Was it?" TikTok marveled, raising his eyebrows.
He had discovered the small button which lit the face of the watch and kept pushing it, watching the light go off and on. Then he looked back at Jake, and his eyes were narrowed to bright green slits again.
"Tell me something, Cully. Does this run on a dipolar or unipolar circuit?"
"Neither one," Jake said, not knowing that his failure to say he did not know what either of these terms meant was buying him a great deal of future trouble. "It runs on a nickel-cadmium battery. At least, I'm pretty sure it does. I've never had to replace it, and I lost the instruction folder a long time ago."
The TikTok man looked at him for a long time without speaking, and Jake realized with dismay that the blond man was trying to decide if Jake had been making fun of him. If he decided Jake had been making fun, Jake had an idea that the abuse he had suffered on the way here would seem like tickling compared to what the TikTok man might do. He suddenly wanted to divert TikTok's train of thought, wanted that more than anything in the world. He said the first thing he thought might turn the trick.
"He was your grandfather, wasn't he?"
The TikTok man raised his brows interrogatively. His hands returned to Jake's shoulders, and although his grip was not tight, Jake could feel the phenomenal strength there. If TikTok chose to tighten his grip and pull sharply forward, he would snap Jake's collarbones like pencils. If he shoved, he would probably break his back.
"Who was my grandfather, Cully?"
Jake's eyes once more took in the TikTok man's massive, nobly shaped head and broad shoulders. He remembered what Susanna had said. "Look at the size of him, Roland. They must have had to grease him to get him into the cockpit."
"The man in the airplane, David Quick."
The TikTok man's eyes widened in surprise and amazement. Then he threw back his head and roared out a gust of laughter that echoed off the domed ceiling high above. The others smiled nervously. None, however, dared to laugh right out loud, not after what had happened to the woman with the dark hair.
"Whoever you are and wherever you come from, boy, you're the triggest cove old TikTok's run into for many a year. Quick was my great-grandfather, not my grandfather, but you're close enough. Wouldn't you say so, Gasher, my dear?" "Aye," Gasher said. "He's trig right enough. I could have told you that, but we're pert all the same." "Yes,"
the TikTok man said thoughtfully. His hands tightened on the boy's shoulders and drew Jake closer to that smiling, handsome, lunatic face.
I can see he's pert. It's in his eyes. We'll take care of that, won't we, Gasher?
It's not Gasher he's talking to, Jake thought. It's me. He thinks he's hypnotizing me.
And maybe he is. Ah,
Gasher breathed. Jake felt he was drowning in those wide green eyes. Although the TikTok man's grip was still not really tight, he couldn't get enough breath into his lungs. He summoned all of his own force in an effort to break the blond man's hold over him, and again spoke the first words which came to mind.
So fell Lord Perth, and the countryside did shake with that thunder.
It acted upon TikTok like a hard, open-handed blow to the face. He recoiled, green eyes narrowing, his grip on Jake's shoulders tightening painfully.
What do you say? Where did you hear that?
A little bird told me,
Jake replied with calculated insolence, and the next instant he was flying across the room. If he had struck the curved wall head first, he would have been knocked cold or killed. As it happened, he struck on one hip, rebounded, and landed in a heap on the iron grillwork. He shook his head groggily, looked around, and found himself face to face with the woman who was not taking a siesta. He uttered a shocked cry and crawled away on his hands and knees. Hoots kicked him in the chest, flipping him onto his back. Jake lay there, gasping, looking up at the knot of rainbow colors where the neon tubes came together. A moment later, TikTok's face filled his field of vision. The man's lips were pressed together in a hard, straight line, his cheeks flared with color, and there was fear in his eyes. The coffin-shaped glass ornament he wore around his neck dangled directly in front of Jake's eyes, swinging gently back and forth on its silver chain as if imitating the pendulum of the tiny grandfather clock inside.
"Gasher's right," he said.
He gathered a handful of Jake's shirt into one fist and pulled him up.
"You're pert. But you don't want to be pert with me, Cully. You don't ever want to be pert with me. Have you heard of people with short fuses? Well, I have no fuse at all. And there's a good 1,000 could testify to it if I hadn't stilled their tongues for good. If you ever speak to me of Lord Perth again, ever, 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 I'll tear off the top of your skull and eat your brains. I'll have none of that bad luck story in the cradle of the Greys. Do you understand me?"
He shook Jake back and forth like a rag, and the boy burst into tears.
"Do you?"
"Yes."
"Good."
He set Jake upon his feet, where he swayed woozily back and forth, wiping at his streaming eyes and leaving smudges of dirt on his cheeks so dark they looked like mascara.
"Now, my little cull, we're going to have a question-and-answer session here. I'll ask the questions and you'll give the answers. Do you understand?"
Jake didn't reply. He was looking at a panel of the ventilator grill which circled the chamber. The TikTok man grabbed his nose between two of his fingers and squeezed it viciously.
"Do you understand me?"
"Yes,"
Jake cried. His eyes, now watering with pain as well as terror, returned to TikTok's face. He wanted to look back at the ventilator grill, wanted desperately to verify that what he had seen there was not simply a trick of his frightened, overloaded mind, but he didn't dare. He was afraid someone else, TikTok himself, most likely, would follow his gaze and see what he had seen.
"Good."
TikTok pulled Jake back over to the chair by his nose, sat down, and cocked his leg over the arm again.
"Let's have a nice little chin, then. We'll begin with your name, shall we? Just what might that be, Cully?"
"Jake Chambers."
With his nose pinched shut, his voice sounded nasal and foggy.
"And are you a Nazi, Jake Chambers?"
For a moment, Jake wondered if this was a peculiar way of asking him if he was blind. But of course they could all see he wasn't.
"I don't understand what—"
TikTok shook him back and forth by the nose.
"Nazi, Nazi, you just want to stop playing with me, boy."
"I don't understand—"
Jake began. And then he looked at the old machine gun hanging from the chair and thought once more of the crashed Focke Wulf. The pieces fell together in his mind.
"No, I'm not a Nazi. I'm an American. All that ended long before I was born."
The TikTok man released his hold on Jake's nose, which immediately began to gush blood.
You could have told me that in the first place and saved yourself all sorts of pain, Jake Chambers. But at least now you understand how we do things around here, don't you?
Jake nodded.
Aye, well enough. We'll start with the simple questions.
Jake's eyes drifted back to the ventilator grill. What he had seen before was still there. It hadn't been just his imagination. Two gold-ringed eyes floated in the dark behind the chrome louvers. Oi! TikTok slapped his face, knocking him back into Gasher, who immediately pushed him forward again.
It's school time, dear heart, Gasher whispered. Mind your lessons now, mind them very sharp.
Look at me when I'm talking to you, TikTok said. I'll have some respect, Jake Chambers, or I'll have your balls.
All right.
TikTok's green eyes gleamed dangerously. All right, what? Jake groped for the right answer, pushing away the tangle of questions and the sudden hope which had dawned in his mind, and what came was what would have served at his own cradle of the pubes, otherwise known as the Piper School.
All right, sir.
TikTok smiled.
That's a start, boy, he said, and leaned forward, forearms on his thighs.
Now, what's an American?
Jake began to talk, trying with all his might not to look toward the ventilator grill as he did so. '29. Roland holstered his gun, laid both hands on the valve wheel, and tried to turn it. It wouldn't budge. That didn't much surprise him, but it presented serious problems. Oi stood by his left boot, looking up anxiously, waiting for Roland to open the door so they could continue the journey to Jake. The gunslinger only wished it was that easy. It wouldn't do to simply stand out here and wait for someone to leave. It might be hours or even days before one of the Greys decided to use this particular exit again. Gasher and his friends might take it into their heads to flay Jake alive while the gunslinger was waiting for it to happen. He leaned his head against the steel, but heard nothing. That didn't surprise him either. He had seen doors like this a long time ago. You couldn't shoot out the locks, and you certainly couldn't hear through them. There might be one, there might be two, facing each other, with some dead air space in between. Somewhere, though, there would be a button which would spin the wheel in the middle of the door and release the locks. If Jake could reach that button, all might still be well. Roland understood that he was not a full member of this quartet. He guessed that even Oi was more fully aware than he of the secret life which existed at its heart. He very much doubted that the bumbler had tracked Jake with his nose alone through those tunnels where water ran in polluted streamlets. Nevertheless, he had been able to help Jake when the boy had been trying to cross from his world to this one. He had been able to see. And when Jake had been trying to regain the key he had dropped, he had been able to send a message. He had to be very careful about sending messages this time. At best, the Greys would realize something was up. At worst, Jake might misinterpret what Roland tried to tell him and do something foolish. But if he could see... Roland closed his eyes and bent all his concentration toward Jake. He thought of the boy's eyes and sent his car out to find them. At first there was nothing, but at last an image began to form. It was a face framed by long gray-blonde hair. Green eyes gleamed in deep sockets like fire dims in a cave. Roland quickly understood that this was the TikTok man and that he was a descendant of the man who had died in the air carriage. Interesting, but of no practical value in this situation. He tried to look beyond the TikTok man, to see the rest of the room in which Jake was being held, and the people in it.
Jake!
Oi whispered, as if reminding Roland that this was neither the time nor the place to take a nap.
Shh,
the gunslinger said, not opening his eyes. But it was no good. He caught only blurs, probably because Jake's concentration was focused so tightly on the TikTok man. Everyone and everything else was little more than a series of gray-shrouded shapes on the edges of Jake's perception. Roland opened his eyes again and pounded his left fist lightly into the open palm of his right hand. He had an idea that he could push harder and see more,
but that might make the boy aware of his presence. That would be dangerous. Gasher might smell a rat, and if he didn't, the TikTok man would. He looked up at the narrow ventilator grills, then down at Oi. He had wondered several times just how smart he was. Now it looked as though he was going to find out. Roland reached up with his good left hand, slipped his fingers between the horizontal slats of the ventilator grill closest to the hatchway through which Jake had been taken, and pulled. The grill popped out in a shower of rust and dried moss. The hole behind it was far too small for a man, but not for a billy bumbler. He put the grill down, picked Oi up, and spoke softly into his ear. Go. See. Come back. Do you understand? Don't let them see you. Just go and see and come back. Oi gazed up into his face, saying nothing, not even Jake's name. Roland had no idea if he had understood or not, but wasting time in ponderation would not help matters. He placed Oi in the ventilator shaft. The bumbler sniffed at the crumbles of dried moss, sneezed delicately, then only crouched there with the draft rippling through his long, silky fur, looking doubtfully at Roland with his strange eyes. "Go and see and come back," Roland repeated in a whisper, and Oi disappeared into the shadows, walking silently, claws retracted on the pads of his paws. Roland drew his gun again and did the hardest thing. He waited. Oi returned less than 3 minutes later. Roland lifted him out of the shaft and put him on the floor. Oi looked up at him with his long neck extended. "How many, Oi?" Roland asked. "How many did you see?" For a long moment he thought the bumbler wouldn't do anything except go on staring in his anxious way. Then he lifted his right paw tentatively in the air, extended the claws, and looked at it, as if trying to remember something very difficult. At last he began to tap on the steel floor. 1, 2, 3, 4. A pause. Then 2 more, quick and delicate, the extended claws clicking lightly on the steel. 5, 6. Oi paused a second time, head down, looking like a child lost in the throes of some titanic mental struggle. Then he tapped his claws one final time on the steel, looking up at Roland as he did it.
Bake!
6 grays and Jake. Roland picked Oi up and stroked him. Good, he murmured into Oi's ear. In truth, he was almost overwhelmed with surprise and gratitude. He had hoped for something, but this careful response was amazing, and he had few doubts about the accuracy of the count. Good boy!
Oi! Jake!
Yes, Jake. Jake was the problem. Jake, to whom he had made a promise he intended to keep. The gunslinger thought deeply in his strange fashion, that combination of dry pragmatism and wild intuition which had probably come from his strange grandmother, Deirdre the Mad, and had kept him alive all these years after his old companions had passed. Now he was depending on it to keep Jake alive, too. He picked Oi up again, knowing Jake might live, might, but the bumbler was almost certainly going to die. He whispered several simple words into Oi's cocked ear, repeating them over and over. At last he ceased speaking and returned him to the ventilator shaft. "Good boy," he whispered. "Go on now. Get it done. My heart goes with you."
"Oi, heart ache,"
the bumbler whispered, and then scurried off into the darkness again. Roland waited for all hell to break loose. 30. Ask me a question, Eddie Dean of New York, and it better be a good one. If it's not, you and your woman are going to die no matter where you came from. And dear God, how did you respond to something like that? The dark red light had gone out. Now the pink one reappeared.
"Hurry,"
the faint voice of little Blaine urged them.
"He's worse than ever before. Hurry or he'll kill you."
Eddie was vaguely aware that flocks of disturbed pigeons were still swooping aimlessly through the cradle, and that some of them had smashed headfirst into the pillars and dropped dead on the floor.
"'What does it want?' Susanna hissed at the speaker and the voice of little Blaine somewhere behind it. "'For God's sake, what does it want?'
No reply. And Eddie could feel any period of grace they might have started with slipping away. He thumbed the talk listen and spoke with frantic vivacity as the sweat trickled down his cheeks and neck. "'Ask me a question.
So, Blaine, what have you been up to these last few years? I guess you haven't been doing the old southeast run, huh? Any reason why not? Haven't been feeling up to snuff?'
No sound but the rustle and flap of the pigeons. In his mind he saw Artis trying to scream as his cheeks melted and his tongue caught fire. He felt the hair on the nape of his neck stirring and clumping together. Fear or gathering electricity? "'Hurry, he's worse than ever before.'
"'Who built you, anyway?' Eddie asked frantically, thinking if I only knew what the fucking thing wanted. "'Want to talk about that? Was it the Greys? Nah, probably the great old ones, right? Or—'
He trailed off. Now he could feel Blaine's silence as a physical weight on his skin, like fleshy, groping hands.
"'What do you want?' he shouted. "'Just what in hell do you want to hear?'
No answer. But the buttons on the box were glowing an angry dark red again, and Eddie knew their time was almost up. He could hear a low buzzing sound nearby, a sound like an electrical generator, and he didn't believe that sound was just his imagination, no matter how much he wanted to think so.
"'Blaine!' Susanna shouted suddenly. "'Blaine, do you hear me?'
No answer, and Eddie felt the air was filling up with electricity, as a bowl under a tap fills up with water. He could feel it crackling bitterly in his nose with every breath he took, could feel his fillings buzzing like angry insects.
"'Blaine, I've got a question, and it is a pretty good one. Listen!'
She closed her eyes for a moment, fingers rubbing frantically at her temples, and then opened her eyes again.
"'There is a thing that nothing is, and yet it has a name. 'Tis sometimes tall and sometimes short—'
She broke off and stared at Eddie with wide, agonized eyes.
"'Help me, I can't remember how the rest of it goes!'
Eddie only stared at her as if she had gone mad. What in the name of God was she talking about? Then it came to him, and it made a weirdly perfect sense, and the rest of the riddle clicked into his mind as neatly as the last two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. He swung toward the speaker again.
"'It joins our talks, it joins our sport, and plays at every game. What is it?' "'That's our question, Blaine. What is it?'
The red light illuminating the command and enter buttons below the diamond of numbers blinked out. There was an endless moment of silence before Blaine spoke again. But Eddie was aware that the feeling of electricity crawling all over his skin was diminishing. "'A shadow, of course,' the voice of Blaine responded. "'An easy one, but not bad. Not bad at all.' The voice coming out of the speaker was animated by a thoughtful quality, and something else as well. Pleasure? Longing? Eddie couldn't quite decide, but he did know there was something in that voice that reminded him of little Blaine. He knew something else as well. Susanna had saved their bacon, at least for the time being. He bent down and kissed her cold, sweaty brow. "'Do you know any more riddles?' Blaine asked.
"'Yes, lots,' Susanna said at once. "'Our companion Jake has a whole book of them.'
"'From the New York place of where?' Blaine asked, and now the tone of his voice was perfectly clear, at least to Eddie. Blaine might be a machine, but Eddie had been a heroin junkie for 6 years, and he knew stone greed when he heard it. "'From New York, right,' he said. "'But Jake has been taken prisoner. A man named Gasher took him.' "'No answer.' And then the buttons glowed that faint, rosy pink again.
"'Good so far,' the voice of little Blaine whispered. "'But you must be careful. He's tricky.'
The red lights reappeared at once. "'Did one of you speak?' Blaine's voice was cold, and Eddie could have sworn it was so suspicious. He looked at Susanna. Susanna looked back with the wide, frightened eyes of a little girl who has heard something unnameable moving slyly beneath the bed.
"'I cleared my throat, Blaine,' Eddie said.
He swallowed an armed sweat from his forehead.
"'I'm... shit, tell the truth and shame the devil. I'm scared to death.'
"'That is very wise of you. These riddles of which you speak, are they stupid? I won't have my patience tried with stupid riddles.'
"'Most are smart,'
Susanna said, but she looked anxiously at Eddie as she said it. You lie. You don't know the quality of these riddles at all.
How can you say voice analysis, fricative patterns, and diphthong stress emphasis provide a reliable quotient of truth-untruth? Predictive reliability is 97% plus or minus 0.5%.
The voice fell silent for a moment, and when it spoke again, it did so in a menacing drawl that Eddie found very familiar. It was the voice of Humphrey Bogart.
I suggest you stick to what you know, sweetheart. The last guy that tried shading the truth with me wound up at the bottom of the Seine in a pair of cement cowboy boots.
Christ, Eddie said. We walked 400 miles or so to meet the computer version of Rich Little. How can you imitate guys like John Wayne and Humphrey Bogart, Blaine, guys from our world?
Nothing. Okay, you don't want to answer that one. How about this one? If a riddle was what you wanted, why didn't you just say so?
Again, there was no answer, but Eddie discovered that he didn't really need one. Blaine liked riddles, so he had asked them one. Susanna had solved it. Eddie guessed that if she had failed to do so, the two of them would now look like a couple of giant economy-sized charcoal briquettes lying on the floor of the Cradle of Lud.
Blaine?
Susanna asked uneasily. There was no answer.
Blaine, are you still there?
Yes. Tell me another one.
When is a door not a door?
Eddie asked. When it's ajar, you'll have to do better than that if you really expect me to take you somewhere. Can you do better than that?
If Roland gets here, I'm sure we can, Susanna said. Regardless of how good the riddles in Jake's book may be, Roland knows hundreds. He actually studied them as a child.
Having said this, she realized she could not conceive of Roland as a child.
Will you take us, Blaine?
I might, Blaine said, and Eddie was quite sure he heard a dim thread of cruelty running through that voice. But you'll have to prime the pump to get me going, and my pump primes backward.
Meaning what?
Eddie asked, looking through the bars at the smooth pink line of Blaine's back. But Blaine did not reply to this or any of the other questions they asked. The bright orange lights stayed on, but both Big Blaine and Little Blaine seemed to have gone into hibernation. Eddie, however, knew better. Blaine was awake. Blaine was watching them. Blaine was listening to their fricative patterns and diphthong stress emphasis. He looked at Susanna.
You'll have to prime the pump, but my pump primes backward, he said bleakly. It's a riddle, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
She looked at the triangular window, so like a half-lidded mocking eye, and then pulled him close so she could whisper in his ear.
It's totally insane, Eddie. Schizophrenic, paranoid, probably delusional as well.
Tell me about it, he breathed back. What we've got here is a lunatic genius ghost in the computer monorail that likes riddles and goes faster than the speed of sound. Welcome to the fantasy version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Do you have any idea what the answer is?
Eddie shook his head.
You? A little tickle way back in my mind. False light, probably. I keep thinking about what Roland said. A good riddle is always sensible and always solvable. It's like a magician's trick.
Misdirection. She nodded.
Go fire another shot, Eddie. Let him know we're still here.
Yeah. Now, if we could only be sure that they're still there.
Do you think they are, Eddie?
Eddie had started away, and he spoke without stopping or looking back.
I don't know. That's a riddle not even Blaine could answer.